If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Thursday, January the 23rd, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow and Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism here at the Hoover Institution. Joining me in studio here on the campus of Stanford University is the brilliant, insightful, redoubtable Richard Epstein.
Woo!
Richard Epstein is the Hoover Institution's Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow, as well as the inaugural Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at New York University Law School, and he is a senior lecturer at the University of Chicago. Richard's also a creature of the world of podcasts. You've probably heard him doing his Libertarian podcast. He and his fellow Hoover fellow, John Yu, also talk all things legal in the podcast Law Talk. Richard, good to see you. A belated Happy New Year, and welcome back to my podcast.
Oh, it's always nice to come out here in January in order to do this show.
Thank you. So we're going to have a little Richard Epstein trivia to start our show today. Richard Epstein grew up in New York. Actually, your earliest years were in Brooklyn, correct?
That is correct, 1943 to 1954.
1954, then you moved to Long Island, right?
Breakneck, Long Island. The day I moved to Long Island was the day that Averell Harriman was elected governor.
Okay. Where were you in the fall of 1951 in Brooklyn?
In 1951, I was not at Dodgers at the baseball game.
Yes.
I was actually perversely a Yankee fan at the time. So the shot at Coogan's Bluff was something I was aware of.
Right.
But it was actually not something that I fully absorbed. I was 8 at the time. So this was on the radar screen, but not front and center.
Right. So you're referencing the miracle of Coogan's Bluff, which is
Bobby Thompson's
three-run homer to win the World Series. I mentioned this, Richard, because there is a backstory to that miraculous season of the Giants in 1951 when they make up 13 and a half. It turns out the New York Giants, now the San Francisco Giants, it turns out the Giants were cheating.
Yes.
Specifically, Richard, they had a coach named Herman Franks. Herman Franks had a very good eye, and he was a very clever man. And the way the polo grounds were set up back at Coogan's Bluff, the Giants had a clubhouse out in center field. So Herman Franks would go out to the clubhouse, and he would take with him a military field glass with him. He'd take a high-powered set of binoculars. He would sit out in center field, Richard, and he would look at the catcher's sign. He had a buzzer next to him. He would then hit the buzzer. The buzzer would go into the Giants' dugout. The Giants then knew what pitch was coming. He'd get relayed to the batter. This is, Richard, a low-technology version of what the Houston Astros have just been doing, with just no video, but just the buzzer.
It's one by land, two by sea.
Right.
Was Paul Revere. One a fastball, two a curve.
Right.
Is all you need to know.
So the point is, there was cheating in 1951. There's cheating in baseball in the late 2010s. There's cheating in baseball in 1951. There's, of course, the 1919 World Series with the Black Sox. There's cheating. Cheating has been a part of that
sport. And there's also 1998 and the steroids and the
yes.
home run game.
Right. But I bring this up, Richard, because I look at what's in the news and I look what's kind of driving attention in the early 2020, and there seems to be this common thread of cheating. You hear Donald Trump talk about trade with China, and what does he say? He says, quote, nobody's cheated better than China when it comes to intellectual property rights, currency manipulation. You look at Iran, and Bibi Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, says that they've cheated on the nuclear agreement, that they're building bombs. So they're cheating. You look at impeachment, and my theory, I want to hear what you think about this, but my theory is that cheating is at the heart of impeachment, not the two articles and what Trump may or may not have done, but it's cheating in this respect that Democrats have been convinced since the moment the votes were counted in 2016, Richard, that Donald Trump somehow cheated his way into office. It was Vladimir Putin and Russian manipulation on social media. It was voter suppression in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan. But Donald Trump is a cheat, and therefore, Richard, impeachment is really punishing Donald Trump for cheating, if you will.
This is a very complicated stuff. Let me start, first of all, with a framework. And the purpose of the framework is to explain why it is in a world in which overwhelmingly number of people are honest, cheating is a constant phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have to do to think about this is to have yourself a probability distribution in which most people are clustered around the median.
Right.
And what most people will always say is we would never do anything so terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And they then do an autobiographical extension to the way everybody else works. But these distributions have tails. And if you have a society of 100 million, 200, 300 million people, there are going to be a large number of people way out there on one tail who do not share the common morality of everybody else. So the reason you get these constant number of stories is a very tiny percentage of individuals will, in some cases, realize their particular behavior, and it will manifest itself in the form of cheating. And then the mistaken thing to do is to say that this is representative of society instead of saying it's representative of the tail.
Right.
But the real challenge is to figure out how it is that you can isolate the cheaters and respond to them either by a set of sanctions in advance that prevent it from happening or by a set of punishments afterwards which take this into account and therefore give you deterrent effect without destroying the rest of the fabric of a particular society. So when anybody starts to say, well, we saw this terrible racist instance, it proves that America is a racist society. No, what it proves is that 0.001% of the people may share this particular form of racism.
Right.
And what you have to do is to be relatively surgical in this. So you can see the steady procession mm-hmm. in a society that is overwhelmingly honest. That doesn't make it any less important because one of the reasons you have to worry about it is if you don't control it, the suspicions are going to be that many other people have practiced it. And if you don't control it, the number of people who are willing to do it may double. That may be a small number from 0001 to 0002, but twice whatever you had is twice, and you will see it again. So it's an extremely vital problem because of both its direct and indirect effects.
Let's go back to your Brooklyn years or your Long Island years for a second. Did kids cheat at that? You went to a PS in Brooklyn, I assume?
PS-161.
Right, okay. Did kids cheat at PS-161?
Well, let me put it this way. I'm sure they did to some extent, but I think it was the same kind of phenomenon. One of the reasons why there was less cheating at PS-161 mm-hmm. was that I started in 1948 with a group of about 36 students, all of whom were Jewish, with maybe one exception. And in 1954, before the entire neighborhood basically became overwhelmed, probably 33 of the 36 kids that I started with were still in my class.
Right.
And so 60-odd years later, I can name 90% of the kids that I went to school with. When you start having a closed community like that, it turns out that cheating is a much more difficult thing to achieve because what you have to do is you have to cheat against your friends, and you have to cheat against people who can know what's going on, and if they know what's going on, they will start to do it. And so as I start to think back at these kinds of things, you would always see the following kind of thing. I was out, no, I was safe. Kinds of situations when you started to play ball.
Right.
Occasionally, there may have been a little bit of cheating on tests of one kind or another. I didn't think of it in that particular way because the way in which the school was organized, at least when I was there, these things, particularly in the lower grades, were not very, very competitive. And in fact, one of my most pleasant memories of being in Mrs. Litwin's class in second grade was she said, well, you're very good at math, and Stevie here has a little bit of problems. Will you teach him how to carry fractions and stuff like that? And so the way in which you managed to control a class with 36 students was to turn some fraction of them into teachers. And just think of what the change of the ratio is.
Right.
Even if you get three or four pairs like this, all of a sudden you got four teachers in the room, and the teacher has to worry about 28 kids, not others. Eddie Lazier, I don't know if you remember this, did some very interesting studies on the stability of classrooms. And this is what essentially he found.
Mm-hmm.
Is you have a classroom of well-disciplined kids like the ones we had in PS-161.
Right.
You get a great deal of good learning done. The moment you introduce one chronic troublemaker and allow him to change the nature of the game, the entire other 35 students in the class will go down. So essentially, the key measure of what difficulty is not the size of the class, it's the number of outliers, which is why the current educational policy of necessary integration without sanctions against troublemakers essentially has produced such very, very difficult results. The theme one always has to remember is if you cannot control the outliers, you cannot protect the center.
Right. You went to college at Columbia, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Was there cheating at Columbia?
Again, I did not know.
Now, in a much larger body of students.
Yes,
and
well known. The things I do remember is that whenever we took examinations, we went into a very large room, and there were 4 feet between the desk in front and back you, and 5 feet between the two desks on the other side.
Right.
And if you were nearsighted like myself, what were you supposed to do? Who were you supposed to cheat from?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it often occurred to me, well, do this. I said, wait a second. What am I thinking about?
Right.
I mean, I'm up there in the top 1 to 2% of my class. I'm going to look at some random person. So it never really occurred to me. My class was exceptionally strong at Columbia. It was admitted only on merit. Nothing else counted. I do not recall anything. And just to take the question next step, my next educational adventure is going to Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the same kind of examination system. And as best I can tell, there was intense amounts of preparation in the way in which you took these final exams, the difference between Oxford and Columbia is in Columbia you took an exam for a class. At Oxford, every student taking law took the same examination. And I was not aware of any particular kind of cheating or any particular kind of sanctions against it. The key feature in a place like England at that time, since the test was standardized, is that you spent an inordinate amount of time going over past tests to figure out what you're supposed to do on future ones. And this is a drain on imagination and so forth. But I'm happy to say, and then when I finally get to the Yale Law School, again, I think I went through a relatively cheat-free environment, but I will just mention for the record, my education of a formal nature ended in 1968. Of an informal nature, it's still going on today.
All right, this is my next question. As a professor, as the table turned and you now teaching classrooms, have you encountered cheating?
Let me put it this way. There have been one or two cases that I've seen in which plagiarism had taken place with respect to certain kinds of papers. Mm-hmm. And the level of sanctions that are imposed are extremely severe, including expulsion. There was one case involving a student which had the following situation, in which I was not allowed to participate in the adjudication. This fellow had a very strong transcript, but in my particular class, he had gotten a 70, which is a low grade. And what he did is he went to the machine, whited the 70 out, put the 80 in there, and then did the copy of it and sent it off to various judges for clerkships. Unfortunately, what this poor fellow did was he left the thing inside the copying machine with the whiteout, and some anonymous person sent it to the dean saying, I think you might want to know.
Right.
Rarely do you have a case where the document speaks for itself, so you don't care who sent it. And what happened is we put into place an enormously exhaustive hearing, got the guy a lawyer and so forth, but there was no way that you could explain why that number mysteriously disappeared from 70 to 80. We managed to get the transcripts that were sent to the judges, and they were all the high transcripts, and the fellow was essentially forced out of law school. And, you know, this is the kind of thing for which ex post sanctions are perfectly appropriate. Mm-hmm. And when you get it in this particular fashion, the evidentiary problem disappears. It's not hearsay, right?
Right.
It's documentary evidence. And if you're a lawyer, you know the enormous difference between he said, she said on the one hand, and there it is in black and white out, as it were. So I think there have been a couple of other cases like that on plagiarism and so forth. But I will say that in my many years of teaching, I have always regarded this, at least within the academic setting, as a distinct tertiary or quaternary situation. It's not something that I much think about. When I do these things, I think the norms have seemed to help on this place. If you would ask me what it is that I find very uncomfortable in education, this would be at the bottom of my list. It's so many other things doing with what are the social mores in class, about asking questions, the role of stereotypes, generalization, diversity, inclusion, and so forth. That's where all the controversy would arise. I tend to be on the minority on most of these issues. But thankfully, what you start to see with the theft of trade secrets and similar kinds of situations
right.
doesn't happen in academics. One explanation, why? We don't have anything worth stealing.
Richard, let's walk through the three examples I gave you of cheating. Let's start with impeachment. And my theory of this is really not so much about what was said or not said during a, quote, beautiful phone call. But really, this is just a Democrat's belief that Trump is a crook. He's beneath the office of the presidency, and he should be removed.
Well, let me put it to this way. When you're trying to impute the testimony that is offered, motivational evidence is always going to be influential, but it's never going to be decisive. But in this particular case, it's extremely powerful because if you start looking at what the motivations were, as you said, the drumbeat began in 2016 about how it was all illegitimate and that Hillary was obviously the moral superior candidate
right.
and the only way she could have lost was the other thing. The fly in the ointment was there was no more inept campaigner in the last critical days of that campaign than Hillary Clinton. She took her troops out of Pennsylvania and lost. She put them into North Carolina
never
and
went
Arizona.
Never went to Wisconsin.
And she never went to Wisconsin. She was contemptuous of the folks in Michigan and in Ohio and so
right.
forth. So you're trying to have a single causal explanation for an election outcome like that. You know that it's just wrong, even if there was some foul play. So that's the first part. The second mm-hmm. part is if you're the Russians, you probably invested a million or two in fake Twitter and so forth. Never has any political form of intrigue had a higher rate of return than that. If you're the Russians, what are you trying to do? You don't care who wins. You're trying to delegitimate whoever does win by planting the seeds of doubt in the public at large so as to undermine the candidate. So I think, in effect, it's there. You get to 2018, and there are a large number of people who are actually announced that they're elected in order to impeach Donald Trump.
Right.
And they're not doing this because they think that they already have evidence. They're doing it on the come. We then come to the Mueller report. I was exceedingly critical of Mueller from the first day that this thing went on. I always thought it was a fishing expedition. And when you started to listen to the report and watch the way the things came out, you realized that they had nothing with respect to Russia. And one of the signs that you have of a corrupt investigation is the only thing that you indict people for are the way in which you they answer questions to your interrogatories. Lying to the FBI, if that's the only crime you have, is a sign that the FBI has done something seriously wrong in the way in which it handles those cases. And the joke about Mueller is when he started to explain what was in the report. What you did is you had the following response. We knew he didn't write it, but now it's pretty clear he hasn't read it either. Mm-hmm. And Mueller has simply disappeared from the face of the globe because it was so inept that the Democrats could not do it. The second count is more insidious because it bore fruit later on. This is the question about obstruction of justice.
Right.
And it's an extremely difficult thing. Because it's one thing to instruct the justice when you try to bribe somebody or do something, but the president has enormous power over the attorney general. The office is, in fact, part of the cabinet, subject to removal and controlled by the president. So if he starts to give them commands, they are essentially lawful exercises of executive power. And the duty then, or the burden, falls on other people to explain why it is that these things are somehow or other illicit, or to use the statutory term, corrupt. Mm-hmm. And if it turns out you think, as I think was the case, that Trump believed that Flynn had been set up, when he says to Comey, please back off of this thing, he's not trying to basically suborn justice by getting a guilty person out of it. He's trying to protect an innocent person from what he regards as potentially ruinous kinds of behavior. My view is if he had that belief, he could even order Comey to do this, however impolitic it might be. Mm-hmm. And indeed, one of the reasons why the system of absolute control legally works is the social controls on a president are sufficiently strong that even when these things are desired, he won't do it. Trump did make a colossal blunder when he appointed Jeff Sessions as his attorney general. The Epstein rule is, if you know there's somebody who has a potential conflict of interest going into a job, you could appoint lots of other people to take it, including, say, Bill Barr.
Right.
And at that particular point, you don't have this constant question of having people recuse themselves, then having subordinates take this in ways that you might not find it pleasurable. So I think Trump, to some extent, brought this upon himself. Mm-hmm. That's not an impeachable offense, by the way. It's just a form of very bad political judgment on these things.
Right.
So you then try to figure out what the substance of the situation is. And Trump, again, misplayed this. What he should have said is, I don't know what Mr. Putin did, and I'm perfectly prepared to believe that there's a long history of Russian and Soviet involvement in American elections, but they're going to do that with or without me, and I'm telling you it's done without me in these circumstances, and I could give you sufficient motive and explanation to why it's true. But as ever, Donald Trump always tries to overstate his position. And so what he says is, the reason I didn't collude with Putin is he did nothing wrong.
Right.
And this is as dumb a statement as you could possibly make. Just the way when you have this meandering conversation with Zelensky, you can say it's a perfect conversation, which it's not. What you should have said is it may not be a perfect conversation, but there's nothing in there which is remotely impeachable, which all of a sudden gives you more credibility. So the way in which Trump has always set himself up is he says, I'm perfect. At which point the implication is if there's the slightest imperfection, then it's guilty of an impeachable offense.
I don't want to make this an impeachment-centric podcast because you and John, you probably have talked about this
yes.
a lot. But I'm just curious. I probably owe you an apology. I've dragged you away from the trial today.
You didn't drag me away from it.
Have you watched
new information.
Have you watched any of it?
Not live. What I do is I look for the recap at the end of the day, and it's amazingly predictable. But the real story of the 2016 election, it comes in the Steele dossier.
Right.
And it turns out we do have known criminal offenses that are associated with that, but we don't have any known criminal defendants in these particular cases. And that was clearly a confection set up, and we don't know how high in the Democratic ranks it goes. There is the Durham report, which is to come out, and that could be truly revelatory. But everything that we have inside the FBI suggests that there was serious misconduct. Everything we know about the FISA court, by the way, indicated that they blundered. Just one simple observation. This is an ex-party body, which to the non-lawyers in the group means you only hear one side of the case.
Right.
The basic Roman maxim is audi alteram partem. Hear both sides before you do anything, right? Well, if you're a judge in an ex parte situation, you have to have a heightened awareness of what is going on and be extremely sensitive to what's happening. And so when you see somebody send something over, Devin Nunes sends something over, which says, here's chapter and verse, you don't write a form letter saying, thank you, but no thank you. I'm not going to look at it.
Right.
That's just a major blunder. You have to examine that. Then when you finally see the Horowitz report, what you do is you say, well, we found out about this on December 9th in a footnote. No, you didn't find out about it on December 9th. You found out about it 6 months ago and you chose to disregard it. You guys are in the block. Then you don't get the right set of sanctions. And then you announce that we're going to rely on some guy named Chris, who is in fact very active in the anti-Trump camp and the anti-Nunes camp, to be your impartial arbitrator. My view is the FISA court cannot function like that. And what you do is you... whatever you think about Zelensky and that hearing, it's small potatoes to the major story that took place.
I'm curious about your opinion of the Senate trial, Richard. In this regard, a House manager is standing in front of the United States Senate, and in theory, he or she is trying to sway the opinion of 100 senators. But look, you and I know that at least 95 to 96 to 97 of them have already made up their minds, and they could care less about what's said. They already know how they're going to vote. The reality, I think, Richard, is that the House managers are not trying to win over the Senate. They're trying to win the court of public opinion.
That is correct.
So I'm curious, as a law professor and attorney, just your opinion of the performance art here, because this is what this comes down to, performance art.
Well, it's very difficult to do it because we haven't seen what the defense thing, except for the introductory statement. Mm-hmm. But Cipollone and Sekulow are very strong lawyers. The rest of the team should not be there.
Generally, this is the president's attorneys.
Yeah, you do not want to bring in Alan Dershowitz. You do not want to bring in Ken Starr. You do not want your team to become the subject of criticism by the other side because of their prior conduct, their prior inconsistent statements, and so forth.
Right.
You want to essentially do this. There is a way in which you think about trials. If you're a plaintiff, what you do is you're a lumper. What you say is the entire facts show conclusively that this unreliable president sought favors from the president of the Ukraine and he withheld aid until he could get them. If you're somebody who's a splitter, what you do says, now let's look at sentence number one on this thing. Yes, he does talk about a favor, but he doesn't get to Biden until three paragraphs later. The favor seemed to have to do more with what's going on. He did not seek to dig up dirt on the Hunter Biden type situation. He asked somebody to look into the fact as to whether or not when there's an obvious conflict of interest, is this going to be a signal for greater misconduct? The Democrats have said, well, we all know that Mr. Hunter Biden is innocent and Joe is innocent because they've said so. That's not the standard for a further investigation. The standard for investigation is there something there which is sufficiently difficult that you're now entitled to make further inquiries. And the obvious conflict of interest, the complete unqualifications of this Hunter Biden job for this, is enough to run further. So if you look at this, recognize that the president now has executive powers over foreign affairs. Recognize, by the way, that if you had turned this over to your own attorney general and said, please put a special unit together, say in early 2016, 17 and so forth, this is Biden kind of thing. That would be a legitimate source of investigation because of the way in which it influences foreign affairs. So I find this is very kind of a weak sort of a situation. And the question is whether or not the Democrats are going to be able to get this sort of broad panoramic view to stick or whether or not the Republicans are going to be able to get lawyers who break it down to individual pieces. And here's, or just to finish it up, as far as I can see, the Democrats in a serious trial have the following dilemma, which it's very difficult to face. First of all, you have to ignore the whistleblower stuff. All of it's hearsay, and they don't want to introduce it into evidence. My view is actually the Republicans should be entitled to examine the guy under oath to find out what his sources are so they can chase this thing back one degree further. But you don't want to do that in the Senate. You wanted to do that in the hearings, which, of course, Mr. Schiff stifled us at that point. So you look at the statement. In the end, you cannot, unless you have a very fervid imagination, assume that they're talking about two elections that were never named and a series of behaviors that are wildly unconscionable. So what you have to do is to put it into context. Well, context begins under Obama. And there's a very serious problem there. Do you give lethal aid to a Luchanian government, which you think is somewhat unstable, when it turns out if you don't, the Soviets are going to take over Crimea or the Russians take over Crimea?
Right.
This is a problem that dealt with everybody. There were hundreds of people involved in this particular kind of conversation. So what you have to do is to go through all of this stuff and assume there's something deeply conspiratorial And you don't get conspiracies when there are 20 people in on every phone call or every particular situation. So I think, in effect, and I've said so from the beginning, this case ought to founder. The second charge is even worse, which is the obstruction of Congress.
Right.
This is so baseless. I mean, just to state it in a single sentence, you must get a judgment which requires the president or his aides to testify before there's obstruction. And if you, in effect, assume that executive privilege does not exist, it's you who are upsetting the balance of separation of powers, not the other guys. The fact that the Democrats voted unanimously on both counts meant that they weren't doing anything, because at least a large fraction of them should have basically balked on the second, even if they wanted to push on the first, and that they were not prepared to do. So everybody says, the Democrats said, well, the Republicans have to be open-minded. They have to look at all the evidence. Nobody's ever said to the Democrats, Mr. Sanders, Ms. Warren, Ms. Klobuchar, and so forth, you're all sitting there. Are you open-minded with respect to the evidence? Are you willing to entertain the fact that what you learn from the defendants could sway your vote?
How many Democratic senators voted to convict Bill Clinton?
I think none, wasn't it?
None. Not one.
What? And you know what? By the way, I was against that. I mean, I thought Clinton v. Jones was one of the great disasters of American Supreme Court jurisprudence. I said to myself, Justice Stevens is a lawyer. Any lawyer worth his salt will tell you that the single most dangerous stage in any case is depositions, because it's easy to make mistakes. You're not confined on what you could ask. It's all put down. You're going to be tempted to lie if you're embarrassed in one form or another. You never want to put a president in harm's way. So what you say is, we will postpone the trial. We will waive the statute of limitations so that you can't be time barred. We will require you to preserve all documents in a neutral place under authority. And we will only begin this trial after you're out of office. That's the correct procedure.
Right.
So they just got it completely wrong.
The Jones you mentioned is Paula Jones.
That's
and
correct.
Richard, Paula Jones, this whole case of Paula Jones starts with an article written in the American Spectator by David Brock, now head of Media Matters and an enormous Democratic backer, by the way. Things change.
Yes.
The title of that story was His Cheatin' Heart. It's about Bill Clinton's infidelities in Arkansas. There's that word again, cheatin'.
Yes. Well, I mean, he was, this is the world's greatest non-mystery. He was a serial cheater. One of the things about Bill Clinton is everybody who ever knew him, particularly in his young days, said he was the most charming and engaging human being that you ever met,
right,
and that you could be in a crowd of 1,000 people and he was talking to you for even 15 seconds. Mm-hmm. You only believed that there were two people alive in the universe. Well, my guess is that charms worked under other circumstances for other ends, and his wife stood aside while all this stuff happened. And so it's no mystery to me, but I think it's a mistake is for anybody to try to take those peccadilloes and to try to bring them into an impeachment mode when it turns out they don't seem to affect affairs of state. So I was against bringing this. I was against the lawsuit starting to take place. I mean, all the wonderful advisory opinions that we get from Gerald Nadler and Charles Schumer and so forth at the time, I think were right. What's so troublesome about this particular case is it's almost impossible to disentangle the ordinary course of duties as a president with very large control over foreign affairs from illicit behavior. And just using the word corruptly before whatever he does 15 times does not get rid of a difficulty when there are always going to be joint motives present.
Okay, riddle me this, Professor Epstein.
Yes.
The American people elect Donald Trump, warts and all, in 2016. You've just told me that the American people elected Bill Clinton in 1992, warts and all, just say,
and well, 96.
He's a hound, but we think he'll be a good president. 1960, John Kennedy is barely elected president, and the American public did not have any inkling about John Kennedy's private life. Are you going to tell me that the American people would have given John Kennedy the benefit of the doubt in 1960? And if not, then what changed between 1960
well,
and 1992?
Well, I think at that particular point, sexual conduct was subject to a much more serious set of rules than it would have been regarded as a more serious offense. I think the Catholic issue would have only amplified the problem because there was already some sentiment against him. For one of the questions I give, I won't ask it to you because I think you're probably old enough to know the meaning of the word, but one of the things I do with everybody under the age of 50 is I ask them, do you know what a parietal is?
Tell me.
See, you don't know either, right?
No, I'm blanking.
Well, when I was in college, the rules were that women were in one dorm, men were in the other dorm, and a parietal was a series of restrictions which made it impossible for men to go up to women's rules.
Okay, I went to an all-male college, Richard. Yes, that's my flimsy defense.
Yes, but even when I went to Columbia all-male, you go to Barnard.
Oh, so you didn't have men on one floor and women the other. You had separate dorms.
I mean, it's a complete separation. Women had to be back by 10:30 on a weekday night, 11 o'clock on the weeknight. Mm-hmm. And I still remember you go into Barnard Hall in the main college. There's a place where you could sit with a girlfriend. What was conspicuous about it is there were 7 doorways and no doors. Mm-hmm. Because they, no matter where you were, people were always going by. And if you got within 3 feet of your girlfriend, you were already dead meat. It was a very different kind of scope. By the time I'm a senior, this is all cracking. So what happens is we now decided, John, at Columbia College, women could come upstairs. But it turns out that you had 2 rules, the 3 feet on the floor rule. And the other one was the book in the door rule. And so, you know, people said, well, this is a kind of a compromise. It lasted for 1 week. And some kid came up with a very clever idea of putting a matchbook and then shutting the door and then keeping the feet off the floor. And it turns out nobody in the administration waved a whimper. And so it was a modest reform became a total reform. So in the years that I was in college, there was a huge transformation with respect to sexual mores. Mm-hmm. This was driven, in fact, by the civil rights movement. It was driven by the Vietnam protests and so forth. 1960 election was essentially an election in the Eisenhower years.
Right.
By 1964, it's a very different world. When I entered Columbia College, we all wear blue, light blue beanies with a white C on top of it. The next year, a few kids had it. The third year, they were joining SDS. So the 4 years that I was in college essentially changed this stuff. And so God knows the expectations of John Kennedy at that particular point were very, very different from anything we have of candidates, say, after 1990, for sure, when Bill Clinton comes on the scene.
Richard, there's a wonderful documentary called Harvard Wins 29-29, and it's about the famous Harvard-Yale football game where Harvard tied them the last minute. Yes. And so the Harvard Crimson has the great headline, Harvard Wins 29-29.
Yeah, the 2 points they have to touch.
And it's a really fascinating documentary because it chronicles the players on the 2 teams, and Harvard has a lot of, you know, it's with Vietnam, it has some veterans on the team, there's a lot of unrest. Tommy Lee Jones, the actor, is on the team. It ties into him and Al Gore. Yale is a different university at that time from Harvard. It's much more buttoned down, if you will. But
what was the year of this?
1969,
the first year of the transition.
Right. And I mention this because there is a very wonderful scene where one of the football players is dating Meryl Streep, for example, who's this kind of mousy future great actress, but she's
She's born 1948. Yes.
Exactly. But anyway, I mention this, Richard, because they are talking about how life changes the late 1960s on campus, and the interviewer asks the football player, he goes, what happened? And the football player looks at him and pauses for a second, and he goes, birth control.
That is only one part of the situation. Let me put it to you this way. I went to college, 64. I go to England for 2 years, 66, to 64, 66. Mm-hmm. Oxford's still a pretty traditional place. Everybody gets neurotic as they take their final examination. There's all women's colleges, all men's colleges, and so forth. I come back to Yale Law School in the fall of 1966, and it was such an incredible culture shock. Birth control was certainly part of it, but the presumption of respectability of American political institutions had completely shattered in the time. Mm-hmm. And the young people, for the most part, my contemporaries, illegitimacy of what was going on was there. This was surely fueled by LBJ, Vietnam, the drug revolution, I think, was part of it, and so forth. By 1970, you get the Kent State shootings. And so all of this period now, all of a sudden, these places all of a sudden start to become male-female instead of being all male. That actually goes pretty smoothly, I think, but it does indicate a kind of a change of social expectation. So there was a lot of free love sentiment floating around then. What was interesting is this is about 10 years before Kitty McKinnon writes the book about sexual harassment of the place. So you get a lot of this stuff, but you don't get the blowback which coming in, oh, yes, you could do whatever you want with consent. And by the way, we never know whether consent is given if there's an ex post regret. So it was a pretty wild period. And when I was at the Yale Law School, I come in 66. The first year class is still pretty buttoned down in terms of the way it goes, the second and third year class more so. The class that comes in 1967, I said, oh, my God, who are these people? It was a complete difference in expectations, dress, style, and so forth. And this was a bit disruptive. I leave the school. And I make way for Bill and Hillary Clinton to come in the fall of 1968. And for my friends who were still there, the change which had begun in 67 had catapulted and become even larger in 68. And between 68 and 71, it was a really kind of a war zone type of place. I was a young teacher at the University of Southern California. And I could still remember in 69 and 1970, I had to give several faculty speeches as a 25 and 26-year-old professor saying, I did not know that I was in the Foreign Service. But it seems to me that as I am figuring out what to do in this law school, what goes on in Cambodia, what goes on in the LAPD is much more important than anything that goes on in this particular classroom. And I wonder, what is my competence to deal with these things and why I should disrupt the life of my students for all this going on? This was not the popular position at the time. And it becomes a major insurrection in the fall of 1970, in the spring of 1970. And then I could still remember the late and great president of USC, Norman Topping. He lived a long life. There was so much protest. All of a sudden, he says, students could take optional final examination. And I remember several of the faculty asked him, why are you surrendering on this? He says, it's really very simple. These kids have gone so far that they can never take their exam. So I have two choices. I can say you have to take the exams, at which point the protests will continue. Or I can say you could take them pass-fail or not at all, and they'll all be at the beach. He says, I preferred the latter. And he was right. A strategic retreat.
So we've been talking about cheating, Richard, and we've been talking about the American public being rather, shall I say, flexible with rules being bent. Yet, meanwhile, we have a president who talks about China, and he uses that word cheating when it comes to China. You've written about this. Tell me your thoughts. Is Donald Trump on track when he uses the word cheater?
This is the most complicated issue. Let me start with the first point. Is I am, in general, a free trader.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I say that, it is so complicated to figure out what it is that you mean by being a free trader
right.
when you see things. There are two huge exceptions that you have to put into place with respect to free trade, both of which I think are clearly implicated with China. About 6 years ago here at Stanford, there was a conference run on how it is that you interact national security issues with free trade issues. And there were a bunch of guys who were in charge of figuring out what kinds of planes, guns, ships, and so forth you could sell to every nation in the world. And the clear concern was, we love free trade, but mm-hmm. if you're going to take grade A American weaponry and give it to our enemies, we don't like that so much. So basically, every single foreign arms deal, there were limitations as to what you could sell, how it could be used, how it was accepted, how it could be resold, and so forth. This was essentially a very heavy top-down bureaucracy. And interestingly enough, there was nobody in the room who thought that this was somehow or other illegitimate, because everybody could understand the blowback. Everybody understood that if you gave it to your enemies, it was a disaster. They understood if you didn't give enough to your allies, it would be a disaster as well. So you're always on a knife edge. And listening to these people talk, it gave me a real appreciation as to just how complex the problem is.
Right.
The second problem is intellectual property. And IP is essentially something which is extremely complicated, because if I give it to you, I can still keep it, and you can infinitely multiply it. So the great danger that you're worried about is that they will take your particular technologies that you give them. You have a confidentiality agreement which has to be enforced in Chinese courts. Good luck. Mm-hmm. They then pass that information out to somebody else who turns out to start a rival business in competition with your own. So many years ago, for a short period of time, I had a single client. And what this client had done was to develop a very sophisticated policy for separating metals from scrap, right? Crap and slag and all the rest of this stuff. So I said, where are you going to do this? He said, we can't use it in China. Because what will happen is the Chinese will basically take the technology, will use it against us. It's a straight theft and expropriation. So the only method that we have is self-help, keeping this stuff out. Well, is that going to work? Well, what you do is you give it to Company X. But Company X has a side deal with the Chinese, right? And they're willing to transfer this information, and the Chinese can use it. You have to be able to stop that. Mm-hmm. Not as easy as you start the thing. So it turns out the Chinese basically are institutionalized cheaters.
Right.
This is not the random person, you know, the liar, the baseball player, and so forth. This is a government which is for cheaters, by cheaters, and through cheating manages to achieve what is parity. So they violate every known international norm when they set up bases in the South China Sea and so forth. They do this with respect to intellectual property. So what you really have to do is to figure out what's going on. So now there's a serious problem.
Mm-hmm.
Free trade is a good thing for aluminum sheets. Free trade is a bad thing when they're stealing intellectual property.
Right.
Do you go at it alone? Do you cut off other stuff and risk retaliation? Do you try to go through the WTO in order to do that? Do you essentially try to figure out how you configure your secrets so as to make them non-theft worthy in some sense? What the basic rule is as follows, and it's a legal principle you should never, ever forget, is it's easy to identify what is a wrong. It is extremely difficult to assemble a set of remedies which is, A, effective enough to stop the problem and not so big as to create other problems of itself. So on this particular issue, I am in general in pretty sympathy with the Trump administration and so forth, right. And in fact would be more critical of the Obama administration, which on this as in so many other things, has kind of turned a blind eye to the problems that they started to exist. How you deal with it, the problem is I'm a law professor. I can spin out the permutations. I'm very good at that. What I can't do is tell you which of the permutations work because I don't know enough about the facts on the ground. So it's a real division of labor. Mm-hmm. And what you do is you have to have theoreticians who can kind of figure out, tell people how to think about trade-offs, but they are useless unless they have the professionals in the field to tell you how it's going on. So, no, I do not get angry at Trump at that. I do get angry at Trump by saying I want to screw up the trade deals that you have with the new NAFTA, right. Get crazy when you start saying that we think it's a national security to prevent any raw steel rolls from coming in the United States. I think it's crazy to have American content rules when you're dealing with your allies and so forth. There are many, many things that he does wrong. But on this one, at least, it's right. And so it would be much better, as always, if Donald Trump yielded in the cases where he was clearly wrong instead of listening to Peter Navarro so he could concentrate on the cases where he's credible. But as you know about the president, hyperbole, overextension, and exaggeration are essential part of his toolkit.
We're on the same page today. I was going to use the exact word hyperbole. This is a man given a hyperbole. Richard, play wordsmith for a second. Mm-hmm. When Trump says nobody's cheated better in referring to China, how would you edit that phrase? It sounds like you're saying this is a country that culturally, institutionally cheats.
Well, actually, I would not edit it. I would expand upon it.
Okay.
What I would say is, look, you know, you start dealing with the many Chinese who've come to the United States who have distinguished themselves in so many works of rhyme. And it shows that when you take people who are raised in a genuinely toxic culture and give them the opportunities of freedom, what they do is they flourish as all other immigrants have come to the United States. But we're not talking about the Chinese people. What we're talking about is an organized group of Chinese people, a coup, a cabal, and it has only gotten worse since Mr. Xi has announced himself to be president for life.
Right.
And it turns out that everybody inside the government is a rubber stamp on what the center is, that this now pervades all public and private institutions. Indeed, there is no difference between them and China. So that if you're a Chinese academic, either you toe the line or you're going to be removed from office and denied funding and so forth. I said, what we are after is to try to say that we cannot do business with the Chinese in anything that looks like a harmonious and responsible way unless they fundamentally reform. They are going to say, don't you dare influence our internal affairs. And what we have to respond is the problem about your internal affairs is they're trying to disrupt our internal affairs. And so what you do is you keep the sanctions on. He's done that verbally more with the Iranians, right, than he's done here. So what he has to do is he has to constantly try to create the wedge between the many decent people in China and the ruling party and to encourage those who are on the bottom to have quiet acts of slowing down the terrible things that go on. Look, the best thing that happened in Iran, Trump does the killing, which I think, in fact, would be justified under international law. Others will disagree. You then get this killing, of the shooting of the plane down, which seems to have been, it was a deliberate shooting under mistaken assumptions. Mm-hmm. And then when the protest rallies come up, they put pictures of the American and the Israeli flags on the ground, and right. all the protesters walk around the flags as a sign of respect. That is a great public relations coup for the United States because it's quite clear we didn't put those flags there. We didn't walk around it. What it indicates is a huge sentiment on the part of the Iranian people and that what I've just said about China is also true there. I've had so many Iranian students that I've worked with in school and after school on so many projects who are so able that what you realize is that a totalitarian government like that can debase the currency and destroy innocent lives. and destroy protective capacities and destroy human decency. And every president of the United States should be sworn to attack that. That was one of the failings about Obama. He could not get moral outrage against bad people. It is not acceptable, in my view, when you're dealing with people who are that horrible, to sort of take this slightly dissented view and say, well, you know, we did a lot of bad things in the Crusades as well. The kind of Trump, or rather the Obama response, was always to find a moral equivalence between whatever American sin there was and the sins on the other side, when they're of complete difference in order of magnitude.
Let me take you back to the new frontier for a moment, Richard Epstein, and the idea of a young Richard Epstein applying to Columbia University, and Mother Epstein and Father Epstein decide that he needs help to get into Columbia. So they hire a consultant. Do you know where I'm going with this?
Oh, God.
The consultant takes a photograph of young Richard Epstein and puts him in a rowing boat. So Richard Epstein is now on a crew team. The consultant claims that Richard Epstein is a talented field goal kicker, so he can be on the Columbia football team. My question is this, Richard. Why do people do this in this day and age? You're probably going to tell me because they think they can get away with it. But this gets back to the question of cheating. These people are cheating the college system. And they...
Look, I mean, as I said, it's only the marginal guy who does it.
Right.
It turns out the marginal people who do it have the following serious intellectual and personal disability. They are part of the elite. They are movie stars. They're billionaires. They're folks who essentially claim to be deep egalitarians, and they always get their way on any matter of importance to them. Mm-hmm. And they think they're really invulnerable to this, that nobody will dare to cross them. And it's just a terrible form of psychology. But most people who are rich and famous like that will not do things like this. So it's the same problem of the conspicuous tail. Then you get the response. Do you really want to make sure that alumni can't make contributions to the college of their choice? Do you want to essentially make sure that nobody could get any coaching in the way in which they prepare for a college education? The tragedy is a system which has worked well in 95-98% of the cases. Do you want to dismantle it because of the terrible results in the 2%, or do you want to do what you actually did here when you find that you really punish it? And I'm pretty much in favor of the latter. I can think, but I'm always open to the possibility, there's some ex ante precaution that you would like to take. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you knew that there was somebody who was an advisor who had been engaged in crooked activities, what you would do is you would send out the form. Mm-hmm. Please, you have to tell us who your advisor is when you prepared for this thing. And if it's somebody who's on that particular list, it's a red flag. Maybe you want to do that. Maybe you don't. Again, same problem. It's easy to figure out the vice. Hard to figure out the multiplicity of remedies when you have to do some before the fact and some after the fact, and you don't know how heavy and serious the sanction should be. Look, a parent who confesses their sins, restores the money, whatever it is very different from somebody who insists upon fighting this thing and pleading noblesse oblige. I know I'm really so good, I can't do it. So I think, look, the lesson about this is moral indignation gets you only so far in the world of social organization. And what you really need to do is have a combination of people with deep moral sensibilities on the one hand and real technical excellence on the other.
Do you obey the speed limit when you drive?
Nobody obeys the speed limit when they drive. Let me put you the following story. I told this to my son. He went out with a teacher, and he was 16 years old, and he had to drive, and the teacher insisted that he go beneath the speed limit. But everybody was 10 miles above the speed limit.
Right.
I said, you are a menace to everybody around you, because the key feature when you're doing highways is not what the speed limit is, it's the variance amongst drivers.
Correct.
So if you are 15 miles below everybody driving 45 when the traffic reads 60, everybody's going to start making turns around you. They may run into you. They may crash into somebody else. And you're sitting there feeling terror. I said, when you're a kid, you do not want to be at the top of the distribution. So if the median is 60 miles an hour, you drive 58 or something right. like that. But I said to him, if you actually follow the law, you'd be crazy. Now, this is something which happens more often than you might think. For example, there are very clear FDA warnings telling you how to use certain kinds of drugs. It's also clear that it's medical malpractice to follow the FDA warnings because the experience that have been accumulated with respect to these drugs' uses indicates a very different kind of pattern for very good reason. And so what you're always faced with the question is, when do you deviate from the formal system to go to the informal system? And the answer uniformly ought to be, if your deviation will lead to a safer society or a safer traffic system than before, you do it. And then you see, well, what's the natural equilibrium? So to give you the Michigan to Chicago illustration, The speed limit varies between 55 and 70 miles an hour. The uniform speed on the road is pretty much between 78 and 82 miles an hour. It slows down in certain 55-mile zones, not because of the speed limit, because if there are enough curves in the particular location, right, you're going to slow down anyhow. So what you do is you want to be in that particular situation. The police understand that. They do not give tickets for people who are driving over the speed limit if they win the stuff. You reserve that for the guys who are going 95 miles an hour. You reserve it for the guys who are weaving, the guys who are tailing, and so forth. It takes discretion. The correct response, in some sense, is to change the limits, right, so as to reflect the reality, and put an 80-mile-an-hour speed limit, or if you're in the middle of nowhere in Wyoming, you put no speed limit at all.
See, that's what fascinates me, Richard, because I was driving up the highway to the airport this morning, for example, 65-mile-an-hour speed limit. Some people in the left-hand lane are going 80, 85 miles an hour. They have a high-speed car. They don't think they're going to get caught by an officer. Off they go. Other people are driving 70, 75. Then all of a sudden, John Q. Law is on the right side of the highway. Everybody slams their brakes. Everybody slows down. But people slow down to about 5 miles above the limit because there is this sort of, you know, agreement between us and law enforcement that if you're not going more than 5 or 10 on the limit, I'm not going to pull you over. So there's latitude within the system to cheat.
The sudden reduction in speed because the policeman is there increases danger.
Yes.
So what you really want to do is you'd like the formal law and the informal law to be a better match. Right. Now, I've just done a recent set of articles dealing with autonomous vehicles, right? And how do you program? Do you program to be with the speed limit, at which point you get a real menace when there are both kinds of cars on the road, or do you do it for the medium? And, you know, Google and the other companies say, well, I can't program this to be unlawful. We may be. What you have to do is to bring the formal stuff into line with the informal stuff. So I would hope that people would start to update their kinds of priors. This happens in every area of law that I am aware of, is there are always two sets of rules. There's a legal set of rules which have heavy enforcement. It turns out it has to be necessarily crude, very broad categories. So within it, you get subcultures that deviate from this with customary norms of a limited application. And generally speaking, you're wiser to follow the customary norms than you are the legal prohibition, at least if you're dealing with an homogenous set of population. So everybody's a driver. You certainly don't want to let drivers go as fast as they can when you got pedestrians around, right? There's a different problem. Right. But how many pedestrians do you allow on I-280? How many bikes do you allow on I-280? How many scooters? You don't allow anybody. The whole point is when you're dealing with high-speed roads, you have to lower the variance by keeping certain kinds of vehicles off. The moment you start talking about, you know, small side streets in Palo Alto, then you have a wider variety of traffic, and the way in which you control that is you really tell people, we're putting speed bumps in, we're putting stop signs in, we don't want you going over 30 miles an hour because we got a bunch of small kids on bicycles that are going darting in and out of driveways.
Okay, we started with baseball, Richard. I want to close out the podcast with baseball in this regard. I'm now taking you back into the 1920s, and I'm making you Kennesaw Mountain Landis.
Ah.
And you have been handed the situation going on in Major League Baseball today. Here's what I want you to help me figure out. So the commissioner of baseball knows the following. The Houston Astros have engaged in a very sophisticated cheating scandal for several years. It has yielded positive results for them. They won a World Series title in 2017, and you can show certain moments in the World Series and in the playoff series against the Yankees before that where it looks like pitches were tipped and, you know, things worked out. The walk-off home run, for example, against the Yankees, that looks like the pitch was tipped. He's sitting on a breaking ball. If you know baseball,
yep,
you sit on breaking balls. But here's the question, Richard. So the commissioner so far has come down hard on whom?
Well,
not labor, but management.
Yes.
Well, the Astros have fired their general manager and their manager after the commissioner suspended the manager for a year. Alex Cora, the Boston manager, has lost his job. The poor New York Mets, they get dragged to this. They didn't cheat, but they lost their manager anyway because he was involved with the Astros. But if you're the commissioner, if you're Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, Richard, do you go into labor over this? Because if you go back in the history of baseball with the Black Sox scandal, he punishes players. He gives them lifetime bans. Right now, the commissioner has gone after the management side. He's not gone after the talent.
Well, first of all, it's not at all clear exactly how many of the management people were involved in the fix in 1919. It was gamblers who essentially approached these guys, paid them off.
Good point.
And so this time they only paid off a limited number of people.
Right.
You know, Shoeless Joe was one of those guys, a 356 batting average lifetime, disappears into the woodwork, right? And so I don't think you had that problem. You also, in 1919, you did not have labor unions.
Right.
And there's no question, there's a story in the Wall Street Journal this morning, which essentially says as follows. You can go after management, and you do not have to fight a collective bargaining agreement.
Right.
The moment you start going after the individual players, there's a grievance procedure that starts to kick in, and this introduces all sorts of real complications. So what are those complications? First of all, is you have a grievance proceeding, and every player can take advantage of it. Then the question is, what's the norm? As a normal human being, I would say that any player who knew about this stuff did not have to be warned that it was illegal. This is what we call malum in se, not malum prohibitum.
Right.
Everybody doesn't have to be told, don't murder somebody because murder is illegal. I don't think you have to tell somebody stealing signs as a form of fraud is illegal. But the players will insist that under these situations, management is under a duty to warn and to explain why all of this stuff is bad. You're then going before a set of arbitrators which are quite sympathetic for this kind of behavior. So there's a serious chance that you're going to lose. It's also a very great risk to the entire structure. If you basically get one player for doing this, you may have to get 20. You don't have the Houston Astros anymore. Do you restock the team? What are you supposed to do with respect to that?
Right.
If you keep going on this stuff, the hearings are going to become public in one form or another. So you've got a year or two of constant bad treatment going on. As everybody knows, the successful players from the 2017 Astros and maybe some years before have now spread to other teams.
Right.
Are you going to start to require these guys to be doing it? What are the sanctions? Are they fines, suspensions, some combination of the above? So what the commissioner did was he made this very tough judgment. I'll get the ringleaders. There were no such ringleaders in 1919. And I'm going to get the player cooperation, and I'm going to let them walk.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he did that. But there's obviously a very strong sanction, which I think he understands, which Alex Cora and Carlos Beltran illustrate. No person who is a player who's involved in the scandal will be a coach or a manager. And so, I mean, essentially, your post-baseball sanctions, when your player days are over, are extremely powerful. And he may well have made the judgment, borne out by facts, that it's better to get this thing done and to do it that way. Now, that's what I said just the opposite. Now let's do it the next thing. You've had your 3-year contract with the Astros. It's over in 2022. And now you want to test the free market. What's going to happen if it turns out you're one of the cheaters? My guess is that your re-signed value is going to be a lot lower than it would have been if you're somebody who's relatively clear.
Yeah, on that note, it's interesting. The pitcher Mike Fiers, who started this by thinking on the ratted on them, he's a free agent, and he may not get signed by anybody because a lot of players think that he broke the code. He shouldn't have done this.
Yes, he's omerta, right?
Right.
Well, so, I mean, what one has to do, in effect, as you think about this, is take into account the collateral consequences.
Mm-hmm.
These are very powerful against those people who cheated.
Right.
If there were members of the Astros who didn't get involved in it, then they could establish that they will not do it. So what he may be relying on is the fact that immunity doesn't protect you from future behaviors.
Right.
On the signing, the coaching, the managing stuff. So if I were a cheater in this thing and I had a protected contract and I'm, say, 27 or 28 years old or somebody wishing to go, the sanctions on you may be less than anybody else, but you could easily be sitting on a loss of $50 to $100 million in lifetime earnings
right.
because of what's going on. And the nice thing about it is the commissioner doesn't have to impose that.
Right.
It's going to be imposed by reputational sanctions, by fans and so forth. So we'll have to see the way it plays out. I've come to the conclusion, my father used to tell me, and I will follow it here, he says, son, sometimes you have to learn to rise above principle. And what he sort of meant by that is there's certain kinds of situations where if you start to impose the sanctions that are duly observed and correctly applied, it creates more problems than if you don't. And
right.
so if you're aware of the larger social context, backing off a little bit and letting those sanctions take place in a decentralized, diffuse, time-insensitive variable, so it could rest for several
right.
years, it may be the wiser thing in which to do. My guess is that that's a lot of what the thinking is going on the part of these things. And I happen to think, as I sort of think aloud on this situation, that they were better to avoid the briar patch in this particular case.
I could keep talking with you about this until pitchers and catchers report, because technology has become a big issue here, because this is driven because there is a TV screen next to the dugout. And why is that TV screen there? Because they want to use replay. They want to be able to challenge on a replay, so they have to have the TV there. There is a push in baseball to automate the strike zone, put robots in charge of the strike zone. So I'm very curious if there's going to be any kind of technological backlash. I do think there's one solution here for baseball, Richard, and it's a phrase you hear in Las Vegas: cheater's justice.
Okay.
If you get caught cheating in Las Vegas, you go in the back of a casino and you may get your fingers broken. In baseball, there is a code of this for a long time. If Richard Epstein is on second base and he's stealing my signs, the next time Richard Epstein comes up to the plate, I'm going to put down a sign for a breaking ball, and he's going to be standing there at the plate thinking a breaking ball is coming, and I'm going to throw a fastball right over his head. Message delivered.
By the way, it's okay for the second baseman to steal, isn't it?
It is. But the idea is you can try to steal the sign out there, but you better not get caught doing it. It's understand you just don't want to get caught.
It's an interesting question.
Right.
Is the social norm that the guy on second base is or is allowed to pick off the sign?
This is what's fascinating about baseball. You are not supposed to pick off a sign, but you stand out there and you try to pick off the sign. But you try to do it in a way where it's not so overt that you don't get caught. Like you're standing up there and waving your hand saying breaking ball. You just do something subtle.
Well,
like
let me put it to you this way. You know, this is like sort of low level speeding.
Right.
If it's consistent and it's done reciprocally by both sides, it's the kind of thing which is creates a little bit of a gimpy leg, but it doesn't cripple you for life.
Right.
Whereas the big technology things do. This is, by the way, the central theme, just to finish on this, in the law of search and seizures.
Right.
Where, of course, you're stealing signs all the time, getting information.
Right.
And the world used to sort of tolerate kind of eavesdroppers, right? Low technology. But on the other hand, you don't allow people to take these various kinds of devices that can collect signs from very, very large distances, peer into people's houses either visually or orally. What happens is, in the world as we know it, customary low-level practices, highly reciprocal, are tolerated but not legalized, whereas the extreme deviations are illegal and are punished. That's a live and let live kind of rule, well established in the legal system.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to apply here. So you turn out to be a moral philosopher of uncommon prescience.
Here's what I want you to look for, Richard. The next time the Houston Astros play the New York Yankees, specifically if Jose Altuve, their all-star former MVP second baseman, comes up to bat and he faces Aroldis Chapman, the Yankees' all-star reliever. Mm-hmm. In 2017, Altuve hits a walk-off home run off of Chapman to win the American League Championship Series. It's one of the great clips in baseball because Chapman is standing on the mound with a big smile on his face. Mm-hmm. And the smile on his face, Richard, is that he knows that Altuve knew what was coming because he's a fastball, he's a flamethrower, and he threw a changeup. And Altuve just jumped on it and crushed it because he knew it was coming. So this gets back to my idea of cheater's justice. Altuve comes up to the plate, and unless the game is absolutely on the line, I would be willing to wager dollars or donuts that Mr. Altuve is going to get plunked. And that is cheater's justice.
By Chapman or somebody
by
else?
By Chapman.
I'm a donut man on this one. Because I think it's too clear what the connection will be.
Yeah.
And it turns out that, as we know, the code against escalation is an extremely important part of baseball and every other sport. And therefore, what you have to do is to guard against that. But retribution there may well be. I mean, and I think Altuve is there. Now, the other thing you could do is you say, I'm not going to change the schedule.
Right.
You might want to strip the MVP.
Well, that's true. Okay. So maybe the Dodgers should go to the White House.
Well, I mean,
there's a whole can of worms here to open.
All such things, there's again, back to the legal matters.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a management type, your job is to keep the train on the rails. Once it gets off the rails, you have no way what's going to do. You don't know what compensations to make for the original errors.
Right.
So good management has come to the following conclusion. We want to reduce the probability of it going off the rails as much as we can. And once they go off the air, off the rails, we hire people like me, lawyers, to figure it out. There's no way the people who have management skills have the kind of rescue skills. You need a Red Adair to put out the fires in doing this kind of stuff. As I like to say, every time I see something like this, I know that the real income of my profession has increased.
Richard Epstein, enjoyed the conversation.
So did I.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Richard Epstein and his colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Richard Epstein is on Twitter, brave man. And his Twitter handle is @RichardAEpstein. Epstein spelled E-P-S-T-E-I-N, @RichardAEpstein. He also, as I mentioned, does two podcasts for the Hoover Institution, The Libertarian and Law Talk. Check those out. Subscribe to them. They're great listens. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.